I really enjoyed the novel. I read it all, and it's a literary book, and I enjoyed the way you set everything up, and it was interesting. It starts out the people are so high, mm-hmm. even though he's off to England for his sabbatical and to finish the book and everything, everybody's happy. There's a little bit of unhappiness that he may be gone for that length of time. But over the period of the book, you see the self-destruction of this marriage. Tell me how you set about to write this book and how you got the idea for it.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just wanted to qualify the erosion of the marriage. I'm not sure that it's completely destroyed, and I wouldn't want
tell what happens at the end, because obviously, I mean, you and I know that, in effect, it has a happy ending. You know, they're back together.
I'm still worried about them by the end of the book.
But they're starting anew, in effect, right?
Yeah.
So it's not a destruction. You know, I mean, it's not a total destruction. So there is optimism and hope at the end. Am I not correct?
I'm not so sure. And I think I leave it at the point that for the reader, I think the reader should make his or her own decisions. I know what I think is going to happen, but I leave that up to the reader. In answer to your question, I'm sorry, I've sort of gotten away from it. I started the book when I missed someone very badly. I suppose that was a central emotional autobiographical truth about this book. Other than that, it's like what any novelist does. You just hinge the situation on things that you are somewhat familiar with, and you collect all your composite characters, and you put them all together, and it's like in theater. You put them together on a stage, you clap your hands, you say places, and you see what happens. And this is what happened. They interacted in a way that surprised me as I was writing it.
Well, you use an unusual literary device. It's not totally unusual. It's certainly been done before, but it's one that you employ. Can you tell me about what this device is and how you use it?
It's an epistolary novel, which means that
it's a what?
An epistolary novel.
I didn't know that.
It's a foot-long word.
That sounds a little menacing, in a way.
Yeah, it is, and rather obnoxious, actually, if you say it at too many cocktail parties, I'm sure. But which just means that it's written through letters and postcards, and that seemed appropriate for the theme, given that it's a correspondence conducted over distance and there's some longing involved for the spouse. And in this case, the letters themselves demanded that, I gotta start again.
That's all right.
This is being edited.
This part I'm leaving in.
Oh. It is an epistolary novel. The form has always appealed to me. It seemed particularly appropriate for this theme. And I think it's used quite differently in that in most epistolary novels, you generally have a single character who's generating the letter, be it Color Purple, Dear God, and it's generally one character. Or you have a correspondence between, at most, two people, generally. Now, in this book, what I tried to do was to give each character, about five main characters, distinct voices, vivid voices. And for me, the epistolary form was a perfect way of getting to the nugget of the first-person narrative voice for each of those characters, for all five characters. And then it all comes up to a little bit of a crescendo crisis, you know, the same form, really, for all novels. But in this case, I think it's a little bit different, in that it takes five epistolary characters, there's that word again, and resolve something, I think, with each of them while working towards a central movement in the plot.
And it works, although you cheat a little bit, because there are some letters that
have
stretches of dialogue.
I'm going to ask you questions now. What do you mean I cheat?
Well, I mean, you have stretches of dialogue within a letter, which most letter writers
don't
put in.
But this is the 1980s, you know, and there are a lot of things going on, and to update an epistolary novel, you have to be, I think, contemporary. And she goes to, at one point, a shrink, as you know, through the reading the book, and she's recounting some pretty feisty dialogue with her shrink because she's reluctant to go. But anyway, it's that sort of thing that is in the book in the form of dialogue and recounted conversations, which she's recounting for friends of hers to help her sort out the situation, which seems true. But it's a fair cheat.
Well, now, you have been working in television. You worked over at ABC. I think you're, according to the biographical data here, you're doing freelance work now as a
field producer, yes.
Field producer and the sort of thing. Now, this is kind of unusual in a way because most people in broadcasting, in television, are not too literary. And how did you develop these literary pretensions?
Yeah. Well, it might be pretensions. I love it.
Phrase that right, did I? It's a literary interest.
Yes, okay. It might be true that a lot of people don't write in broadcast areas. But I don't think it should be true. I don't believe in these perfect divisions. In fact, as you know, in networks they tend to compartmentalize you for what you do. And I don't believe that that has to be the case. I believe it is the case when I look around me and I see who works where, that sort of thing. But I think that you have to have something to draw on as a writer. And a lot of writers have had other jobs at the same time. I will say, however, that I never do both things at the same time. In other words, if I'm working, both are such obsessive commitments that if I'm working on a film, in fact, I've just recently finished a film on Grenada, which is going to air on Frontline, the invasion. Remember when we, I should say, intervened in Grenada?
No, it was an invasion.
Yeah, okay. In 1983.
We had to punish somebody.
Gotta know who you're talking to. but anyway, that'll be on February 2nd. But I think people have to have something to write about. And I was always amazed in going to, I've only been to one kind of workshop class situation, really. And I was always amazed to see there were these terrific writers, terrific young writers. And they didn't have a subject. So it wasn't a matter of craft. You had the most crafted sentences, most perfect syntax, grammar, and there was something missing because they didn't know anything about life. I don't know.
Well, that or they're not storytellers. You have to want to tell a story.
Exactly.
And look for
exactly.
One to tell.
That's exactly right. And the story is the thing. And I think that a lot of people lose sight of that. So anyway, getting back to your original question, I think of all fields, the one that I am in exposes me to situations where I can't possibly use the material. For example, in your case, you have a 2-minute spot. There must be so many things left over that you want to say or to use or feel passionately about. And for me, the residuals so outweighed anything I ever put into something I was working on that I felt I would pop if I didn't express it another way. So I don't think it has to be the case for anybody who thinks or feels deeply about what he or she does, because it's more unnatural to compress something in a small broadcast form than to express it in a longer version in another form. So I guess novels will always be for me, not in a bad way, because there's certainly a lot of discipline and self-control and craft involved, but in a way it's kind of spilling over
it takes a great degree of compression too. I've seen
especially, may I add, in an epistolary novel, that was such a difficult form to tackle, and I'm glad if it looks somewhat effortless, but I've got to say the economy required to put together an epistolary novel is awesome, because you've got to advance the plot, and at the same time you're given quite short shrift to bring your characters to life, which is why, as I say, I have 5 of them, which gets me down to the vividness of each first person singular.
Well, I've read many novels that were out of control, that James Jones, certainly his later novels were out of control. Pat Conroy, his last book, title which escapes me, Prince of Tides. That was a book that was out of control, or even though it made the bestseller list. What?
No, I'm just laughing because perhaps he was drawn to some economy in my book, which is like, I have the reverse tendency, which is to compress, but he's the one who wrote the comments.
Oh, that's right.
My dust jacket,
that's
which,
right.
You know, This book is pure magic. I loved reading every page of it. And Mark Sidaty.
That's nice. That was nice of you, sir.
Yeah, it is nice.
And many elements of his book.
Well, he's a Southern writer, too, which is, I think, to some extent, their self-imposed license to keep going.
Yeah, really, he did. I mean, on and on and on. And it was a...
I think everybody wants to be Thomas Wolfe.
That book would have been a much better book from a literary standpoint had it been trimmed. Now, I read the book. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. There were some implausibilities to it. But it just really went on too long. However, many publishers like these big books because they invest a lot in them.
They promote them a lot. Yes.
And if it looks big, they think it's going to be a big
seller.
There you go.
Which is why I happen to be thrilled with my publisher. It is very unusual and I was lucky in that I did have many offers on this book. But I think I went with the best one because they really had an appreciation for this specific book. It's really, in that regard, not one of those big, fat books, and I care very much about the craft, and I'm not worried about getting to X number of words or impressing anybody, frankly, other than myself, in terms of a job well done.
Well, I do believe that authors should not write a book that's longer than 200 pages. The reason is that if you do a book review every day... You want a lot more economy.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm conformed to your needs as a reviewer.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. What in your background led to your literary interest?
Good question. I've always been a writer. I've always been writing.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of New York in Westchester County. But you don't... I never wanted to write anything and try to get it published just for the sake of publishing a book, hence my other profession, which is what I really rely on for my bread and butter, the field producing for documentary films. But I got to a certain point where I had something to say. Who was it? Now I'm blanking completely, but there's a writer who said that nobody should write anything before the age of 30, which... and I feel that now I'm ready to write. But I've always been writing. I think anybody who has had that urge to express him or herself in a on the page has started very early. It's always been a central impulse in his or her life, and that's definitely the case for me. I just didn't feel anything that was worth writing about. That said, just to show you what a state of innocence I was in when I started this, I had an... To all writers out there, take heart, because I had no agent, I had no publisher, I had nothing. I didn't even have a job at the time. I had an electronic typewriter, a Canon TypeStar D, not even a word processor, and I got going, and a lot of it is just plain discipline. You just get up every morning, and whether something happens or not, you report to that page as you would report to your daily broadcast. There's a lot of that involved. So, I've always been a writer, but things converged in a way that you can't explain, but to which I am just as committed to as I am to documentary filmmaking.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. How does one become a freelance documentary
film
producer?
Yeah.
That sounds like a really tough job to land. I mean, you can land it at all.
I think I came in just at the cusp of when it was possible to get trained. I really feel sorry for people coming out of schools who really care about documentary films, also because there's not that much out there. A lot of the main documentary units have folded, and there doesn't seem to be that much of a commitment to documentary film on television. So, in my case, I graduated early from college. I was brought on as an intern for the documentary unit of ABC News.
They pay you?
As an intern? Oh, no.
No?
Oh, no.
Yeah, because our interns
are not paid. That's a good question. You tend to forget you should ask those questions. And really, one should be paid. That's part of the idea, too. But I worked just for a few months.
That's what they offer here. They offer college credit.
But they were very honest about it. But I worked for free for a few months, and then they hired me as, you know, the whole thing, desk assistant. I was ripping wire copy and carrying around these enormous film cans to film labs where they'd negative match. So I really got into the, I saw the process each stage I was involved in, I used to spend at that time a great deal of time in the editing room, even as a desk assistant. I lived in the editing room. I saw top editors cutting films. That time it was films. I should add, now at ABC there's a scorecard between film and tape, and film editors are now have been trained in cutting tape, and tape is winning. Certainly beta is right now. But anyway, the point is, I started as a desk assistant, then I was a researcher, then a production associate, and, you know, inch your way up. Or at least in my case, some people came in rather august positions, not having been trained in anything. But at the time, there was a lot more money in documentary film, and there was a quick turnover. There were 12 one-hour shows a year, and that's the way to train. When I had an idea, the first thing I'd do is go to Washington and talk to some subcommittee member about, you know, X, Y, or Z subject. And that's the way to do it. You just keep on reporting, learning, and then learn about the craft itself, whether it's filmmaking or writing. You got to know something about something. And what amazes me these days is people who come out and don't have an opportunity to train in some of these areas, which is terrifically discouraging.
The documentary that you worked on, dealing with the Grenada. Now, who produced that?
Open House Films produced it. They do a lot of terrific documentaries for Frontline, and the reporter on it was Seymour Hersh. She's a terrific, terrific reporter. Yeah, and that's going to air on February 2nd. Just about
so you were down there calling the shots.
Well, in that particular case, I did. He's a terrific reporter. Nobody should even try to be in his shadow, but I do a lot of the, as a field producer in general, I do a lot of the pre-interviewing, location scouting, and then go back down with a crew, hire the crew, do all the logistics, that sort of thing. It's the work itself, which I love, and the research, the advanced research before you go down.
I can't
help
thinking that when all is said and done, you can pick up a copy of Long Distances and say, this is all mine. I mean, I had to work with Cy Hirsch and had to work with X number of people to do the documentary, but Long Distances is mine, from the first word to the end.
You know, that's really a very thoughtful thought, I can say that, because what used to frustrate me a great deal is that I work very hard on documentary films, and I used to see the credits, and I am not, as some of my friends say who are in different fields, they say things like ego-intensive. I'm not at all. But really, after a while, when you see the list of credits on a film, which is a very, it takes a lot of people to put together a film, and what appeals to me, and this is, you know, you asked about two careers and how I deal with it, but frankly, it's completely consistent with how I think people should work. There is one side of me that is intensely gregarious and needs that expression through film, working on films. There is another side of me, as there is to everybody, that needs a concentrated form of expression, and I need to be alone a lot. So that's what comes out, or that's what I use for the books. But you're absolutely right. It is, there is nothing more satisfying. Never mind the publishing stuff, which actually turned out very well. I'm pleased. It's a beautiful book. They've done a beautiful job with it. It's a tough thing in terms of a design, from a design point of view, to do an epistolary novel. But the point is that when you finish the last page, that's what really gives you a sense of completion, you know. And
sometimes when you finish the last page, you have to start at the first page and work it over again.
Well, it's interesting because in an epistolary novel, it's sort of like, well, Nabokov used to write with index cards, and in an epistolary novel, you're slugging in pages, so it's easier to revise, and in that case, I didn't need a word processor. The novel I'm working on now is not, everybody will relieve to know, an epistolary novel, and you do need a word processor for that, because you, when you move back through the text from the beginning and you're replacing things, it just, it shoves everything ahead. It's like a snowplow. So that's completely different.
It does take discipline, though, doesn't it? Do you have to get up in the morning and sit there in a certain
I get up
isolation?
Every morning. In fact, it really, I don't know if I can say this word on CBS, but it really pisses me off when friends of mine will call me and they'll say, oh, isn't it nice? All you have to do all day is just think about these things and write. And they plug into jobs every day that organize their lives for them. And I haven't told many of this, but it really pisses me off when they say, oh, you sort of pat me on the head, and oh, isn't it nice to be sit around all day and be creative. It's a hell of a lot of work. It really is. And it's the worst kind of work. It's the work that you can't rely on. It's the work that's insecure financially. It's the work that just drains everything out of you if you take it seriously. So I wake up every morning.
Yeah.
I go straight to my... I usually reread what I've done, and I go straight to my Macintosh, and I work until lunch, take a swim, and go back to it, and for a change of place to get out of my apartment, work in a library in the afternoon. It is a discipline, primarily. It really is.
And the uncertainty... The uncertainty of not knowing if you're doing it right, the uncertainty of not knowing if it's going to find a home.
It's walking
a tightrope in a way, isn't it?
You've got to do it because you enjoy the process. And anybody who has any other ideas, anybody who starts with the premise, I'm going to write a blockbuster that's going to make me $1 million, I have absolutely no respect for, I must tell you. Just zero respect for it. You've got to really care about what you're doing. And I care very deeply about what I do and about writing. And if this next book is crap, I'm not going to publish it.
It's not going to be crap. obviously, it's not. You got off to a great start with Long Distances. You have such a pretty name. I'm sure I'm going to blow it on the air. Pronounce it for me.
Fabienne Marsh.
Fabienne.
Fabienne.
Fabienne. It's French.
Yes. It's sort of like Do-Re-Mi, Fa, and then Japanese.
That's
Yen.
Such a pretty name.
Thank you. My mother is definitely French.
Well, I want to congratulate you with Long Distances. It's a very, very nice book.
Thank you.
I know
you're
that
very kind.
The readers are going to enjoy it. And the pub date is about 2 weeks from now, right?
February 10th.
But you can hardly wait. You have a big party?
I'm going to have a party. It's. I hope it doesn't change everything. You know.
You hope it doesn't?
I hope it doesn't. I don't know why. I care very much about, you know, my privacy and things like that. So I hope it doesn't. But
well, I have to warn you.
Warn me.
Vance Brugeli was telling me he wrote his first book. It came out, I believe, in 1946. He wrote it when he was living up in Maine, mm-hmm. and it dealt with his experiences in World War II, sort of a semi-autobiographical book. So the publication date came, and he woke up in the morning, and there were no trumpets, there were no brass bands. His mother called him. There was no party.
So that's even worse, is what you're saying.
There were virtually no reviews. It was a long silence.
Well, especially now in publishing, as a friend of mine told me, a first novel is like a baby, and if you don't feed it, it dies. And the most important thing is for people to read it. I really want them to read it because I think that there is something in this book for everybody. I really do.
Well, you don't want to just sit there reading it yourself off the screen of your Macintosh.
No.
In fact, Vance Brugeli was telling me that after he published this book, the local bookstore up there had a small display, and he walked in, and there was a woman. She was browsing, and she picked up his book and put it down. He walked over to her, and he said, "I'm the author of that book." And she said, "Oh, well, that's nice." And he said, "Well, if you buy this book, I'll sign it for you." She said, "What do you mean?" "I'll autograph it. I'll put my name in it." She said, "Well, I'll buy the book, but I don't want you to put your name in it." He said, "Why not?" He said, "Well,
if
I were buying it for myself, I'd have you put your name in it, but this is going to be a gift."
Oh, that's heartbreaking. I don't like that story. I take back what I said.
I had that anecdote on my broadcast. But that shows you, I mean, I always like to talk to people, established or first novelists such as yourself, about the origins and how these books start and how they feel when the book first comes out and all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So often, even though they're... Well, some people hit it too big. William Styron, who was certainly in his 30s, he was 26 when he wrote Lie Down in Darkness. Mm-hmm. This was a highly regarded book right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
Just catapulted him into the leading ranks of writers. Other Vance Brugeli started slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So you just don't know. Just don't know. But one thing you can say, that anytime you complete a book and you've gone the distance, the long distance, it's an accomplishment. And that's exactly what it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you.